This is The State of Things, and we are broadcasting live from downtown Asheville from the studios of WCQS. I'm Frank Stacio. Moog Fest is going on here in Asheville this weekend. As you know, Robert Moog was a pioneer in the world of synthesized sound, and one panel at this year's Moog Fest will investigate sounds from outer space. You can't actually hear sound acoustically in space, but of course electromagnetic radiation can be recorded and processed to let us hear the intergalactic soundtrack. And filmmakers have attempted to replicate the sound from space for decades. I mean, you think about E.T. or Star Wars, WALL-E, any number of films that try to give you a sense of what it might sound like. And they could be onto something as well. Charles Lindsay is a multimedia artist and artist in residence at Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI. Eric McDougall is the founder of Black Ink San Francisco, and they're both going to take part in the Sounds of Space panel. They're here with us live on The State of Things. Charles and Eric, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Eric, let's talk about this, how we've tried to represent the sound of space historically.
Well, you know, we're great imaginers, human beings are, and our composers, whether it's Holst and his Planet series or these Hollywood people like you've mentioned, have tried to conjure the sounds of space since the beginning. And I think that really is what is in our heads as a kind of the moment of it. Shall we hear an example?
How about that? We've got a clip from the film Contact, which I think might give us an idea. There's a little bit from the soundtrack from an ethereal sound. But talk about that. And Charles, I'm going to ask you the same thing, but I'll stick with Eric for a second. What's happening there? Why is that how we imagine space?
Well, first, that let me just mention that was written by Jerry Goldsmith, who is fantastic at doing these soundtracks. I mean, he did 5 Star Trek films as well. But you notice the qualities of it. They are – it's floating. It's ethereal. It's often – without rhythmic content that we're used to. And so that is one of the through threads when you take a sample of the kind of music that is typically used to represent space.
Charles, you are an artist in residence at SETI. SETI famous for trying to get the sound of space and communication, the idea that somebody's trying to communicate with us, or whether they're trying or not, we might be able to hear things. How do you work as an artist in residence? Where do you fit in the SETI scheme?
Well, it's a great question. Of course, SETI is they are listening for listening. It's not in the audible range, but listening for signals from technologically advanced civilizations. That's what they're doing. They're not transmitting it at this time. They're listening. So my work is I'm very influenced by the idea of space, and I would say what you said earlier with Eric is the idea that we imagine these soundtracks as the sounds of space. No, I mean, it's not really. I mean, that's an abstraction. It's an emotional idea about space. Bill Kurth, who we'll be speaking with, is really dealing with actual sounds of space, and so he'll be on that panel. He's not in town yet. I'm interested. I'm intrigued by the idea. I'm turned on by the idea of thinking beyond ourselves, beyond the anthropocentric, thinking about the universe. I was educated as a scientist, geologist, actually, but I am an artist. So I'm this hybrid sort of person who's taking the ideas and the hard science. Of course, science is evolving really quickly right now. By the way, you know, SETI this past week, I was at the Institute, and it was fabulous because they announced this Kepler discovery of a Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone 500 light years from here. I mean, it was really exciting to be at the Institute. I mean, you got this, you know, all the scientists, it was all buzzing. And by the way, at SETI, it also includes the Carl Sagan Center for the Study of Life in the Universe and imagining what life might look like, not just the sounds of it.
And you talked about Bill, who's going to be on your panel. He's an astrophysicist, so he's actually collecting some of this electromagnetic spectrum that can then be kind of translated or processed into acoustic sounds.
Sure. So then we're going right from the literal sounds of space as best as they can be approximated to the idea of space, to the emotional aspects, to the interpretation, and then depending how far, you know, we go with our panel, we'll talk about, you know, the implications of space. I was working this past week. I recorded the sound of the quantum computer at NASA Ames, and so this is my way of approaching quantum computing. And when you start to get into that and string theory as an artist, you know, this gets into fabulous territory. It gets big. But in some ways, it's all listening, I suppose.
It's all listening, and it all affects us emotionally. But that's, Eric, getting back to these points that we're making here. If we try to take the data and say, well, let's make sense of this, given our prejudice, right, given the emotional baggage that we carry about space being this exotic place without a rhythm that we recognize, interpretation becomes kind of the big problem, right? Even if we got the data, if we got the message, if it's not what we're expecting, we might just miss it, right?
And often we shape that into – we take the raw sounds from space that might come through a very thin pipe data-wise, right, from, say, a Voyager satellite that is sending us an 8-bit signal. So we get this 8-bit data, and then you have a group like the Kronos Quartet, which is very interested in taking those samples – that come from Bill's work and implementing them into their compositions as samples. But in order to make them something that we can all hear, it has to be translated to some extent. And often those translations we find tend to kind of evoke that sound kind of that we already have in our head of what space should sound like.
So tell us about your work, because that I think explains exactly why we want artists and scientists to work together to come up with some processing that will then give us a sensible or a variety of sensible ways to process this. Tell us about your work, Charles, and how you approach your compositions.
Well, so let me tell you about the project that I'm doing now. The SETI Artist in Residence program puts an artist with a scientist. The scientist I'm working with is Lawrence Doyle, who is a quantum mathematician, information theorist, fantastic scientist. He's been on Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman, and I mean, he's an amazing man, very, very broad mind. So Lawrence wrote, he's also been involved in the early exoplanet searches. One of the things he's done is he wrote the algorithms that determine that humpback whale communications have syntax, which suggests that it's a language. So, you know, this is amazing stuff, and you could see why he's at the SETI Institute, besides the hybrid science, is thinking, if we can't communicate with these whales, with this advanced species on Earth, how are we going to communicate with aliens? And it's a really good question because, you know, we know how we communicate. We imagine those terms, but there could be almost surely there are. I happen to believe there's life all over the universe. It's just pretty far away. But for sure, the communications must be things we can't imagine by definition. I mean, look what we've done in 150 and 20 years, and that's just – that time frame is nothing at all. So I'm interested in this. So I took the idea of the whale communications, and Lawrence has been working with the Alaska Whale Foundation. I have these folders of whale vocabulary. We don't know what the vocabulary means yet, but it's a vocabulary. It's distinct. And then I'm working this year, you probably know because you're in radio, it's the 100th anniversary of Marconi. So the last operational Morse code facility is in Bolinas, north of San Francisco. And I was doing an installation there. So the engineers there transmitted two and received two messages for me. One is, what are the whales saying in Morse code? Blah, 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 blah. And then the other is, all we need is love. So I'm taking those messages. I'm bringing in the audio of the Morse code. I'm mixing it with the whale. And then the other thing I'm doing, which people be at Moogfest, particularly electronic musicians, might be interested in, is Ableton Live allows you to drop an audio file and convert it to MIDI. So then I'm taking the cadence of the MIDI and applying it to the whale calls and other software instruments and samplers so the cadence is matched to create a sort of sonic composition. Rather than delivering it live, I deliver it in really an installation. And I'm building these sculptures that looked like the scoop-shaped air vents on 20th century freighters.
Are they static sculptures, or
they're
are
static,
they
static, but move? They're not inside. Yeah. So they're painted aerospace white. They're about 7 or 8 feet tall, the first ones. And so down inside them, they have projectors. They rear project up, and the speakers run up. So they project sound and light, and then the rear projection goes on to a fabric down in these sort of scoop-shaped, these flower kind of organic-shaped things. So actually, if you approach them and look down in, then the image sort of resolves on the screen. The images are abstract sort of macro video of the tubes in the Second World War era transmitters flashing in sync to the Morse code. And so those are debuting at the Bolinas Museum in June.
We don't have the entire composition here, but we do have at least some of the code of the humpback whale. Now, is that processed in any way, or is that a live recording?
That is totally. That's not the Morse code, but it is actual samples of whale,
mm-hmm.
and then I've sliced and shuffled those. I mean, that's much more in electronic music territory. I think you also have a clip of just the straight Morse code message of what are the whales saying. I'm not sure if that's cued or not.
Well, we don't have that one with us today, but all of this sort of raises the question again. There's in any kind of language, right? I mean, we're assuming that sea mammals somehow communicate, right? And they're using these sounds. We don't know exactly what they're saying. Part of it is because it's a logic system, right? I mean, it represents a system of logic. And for humans, we use speech, and it represents kind of how we see the world, how we've experienced the world. The problem, it seems to me, Eric, is that if we try to apply our logic system and we use that to interpret animals with entirely different experience, we might run afoul of their whole logic system. We may not be able to get there.
It's a good point. I mean, if we can not understand the logic system of dolphins or whales yet, how can we hope to understand that of an alien or of an alien culture or of a silicon-based culture or one that's quite vastly different than our own levels of perception? So that's a great question. And I think it really touches on the notion that what we've been talking about in gearing up for this talk is the notion of listening. And where do our ears bias the way that we listen? I mean, and how good a listeners are we? And in a sense, asking the questions, what is sound and what is space? Because if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, the audible section is very, very small compared to sort of the range of things that exist out there. And of course, you know, SETI and people like Bill are listening at a much, you know, broader spectrum than our ears are. But in order to understand and to comprehend these sounds, we do need to process them within an audible spectrum.
And dealing with the spectrum, and I think that's the key word here, is just the right approach, because when you use that word spectrum, you take us out of this binary. So I'm not locked into the emotional response I had versus the intellectual understanding I have. If I use my ears and allow the whole being, right, to come to me, I have a much broader understanding of that. It seems to me that that's what the artist can do, is process in that broad spectrum rather than lock us into the binary of, well, that was an emotional response. How could that be, you know, sort of a scientific answer to what are they saying?
Great. I mean, I love the challenge, and it's true. So, you know, what we were talking about sort of to finish, well, a couple of those things. But so at SETI, of course, we're really talking about information theory, and that's where the whales, it is a language. And obviously we're doing that thinking about E.T., then we have these actual sounds of space, however they're processed. And then we have music, which I think is the body of what we're talking about at Moogfest, which is this emotional abstraction. We can call it a language, but it's, you know, we all know, like, it's this is amazing language. And when I say that, I'm really thinking music without lyrics. You know, just take the language that there's no more information than this emotional feeling.
But it seems to me that it really argues for all of us to be involved in the artistic work, right, of processing. In other words, we look to a pioneer like Robert Moog, and we're grateful that we now have tools. We can play with this stuff, and in playing with it, have a better understanding so we can expand our ideas of what space is. And I'd love to see the installation, but I'd also like to be challenged to make something like it and come out of this festival saying, I want to do one of those.
Let me add another word to spectrum, and that is synthesis, right? So that's what Moogfest, in a sense, is sort of rallied around the notion of synthesis and synthesis in its real deeper meaning, not just sort of manipulation of circuits to make music, but using the whole synesthesia, if you will, to kind of understand things.
That's kind of the upside and the downside of new technology, right? On the upside is that we can actually, it's more democratic, right? We all have access. We can do stuff. Downside is it's kind of made us in some ways more passive consumers. Like it's so much stuff out there we can just put on our headphones, plug and play. Do you think there's a challenge to us to sort of become more active?
We evolve with our tools, and there's always going to be people that sit back, and then there's our people that jump in with the tools. Eric and I are both gearheads, so we can't have too many tools. The tools are fantastic. I mean, it's just – and so, you know, I see myself as an artist. I'm an explorer, and these tools allow us to explore sound. We can create things that – I mean, I like the idea that and the synthesizer and the Moog gear, the analog gear in particular, speaks to this. You go and you turn the knobs or whatever, you know, that image is, which there's a lot of truth to that. But things can come out the other end. We can hear things that we didn't anticipate. It's not like saying, I want to go make this sound gonk. I'm going to go make that. And that's the thrill is when you're improvising with synthesizers, things happen that you couldn't have predicted. And in analog gear, you know, where you don't have presets and you can't go back, you turn the knobs and it's gone. That particular thing is not coming back exactly like that. And that's really exciting.
We're live from Asheville, the studios of WCQS, Moogfest going on this weekend. My guests right now are Charles Lindsay and Eric McDougall, and they're going to be speaking at a panel at Moogfest. They're going to be talking about the sounds from space. You are listening to The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. How do you think, Eric, let me ask you this, and I'll ask both of you, I'll start with you, Eric, whether or not our ideas about space are changing now that we have access. I mean, you can put sounds of space into YouTube and you can get some really cool NASA stuff and you can hear something like what's happening out there. Are our ideas about space changing as a result?
I think in general, things like the internet have made that level and Wikipedia have made that kind of inquiry much broader, more available to people everywhere. And I think that our knowledge base is sort of expanding, right? And I think – and we were talking about some concepts. You know, I actually went online as the moderator of this panel to kind of understand some deeper science that I needed to kind of think about. And with Charles's exploration around this Marconi anniversary – I asked him the question, we have been putting out radio waves into the universe since Marconi times. And around World War II, the signals became a lot stronger. So if you imagine this metaphor of us dropping little pebbles in a pond and those ripples going out into space, and then around World War II, us dropping bigger pebbles that sort of took over the ripples of the earlier ones, and then the question is: these ripples go out into space, and have formed a kind of giant sphere around our planet that becomes a potential zone for other people who might be listening to us. And the question then becomes: how big is that sphere? Well, you can calculate it, and it. I don't know, was it 50 light years we were sort of guessing
however
at?
Long it's
something
been
like that.
Just in the last 100 years, or even the last 60 years or so, that we've
rippled
that
out.
That's how far we should have gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, has it changed too? Because there's always resistance, Charles, to this idea of intelligent life in outer space. I've always thought it's because when you say that, you expect to see me 60 light years away. And so we have to broaden our idea of what intelligent
means.
Well,
we are so anthropocentric as a species. And I think to your question, you know, is our understanding of space different? I mean, it's dramatically different. I mean, look at the information that's coming in from Kepler right now. It is only going one direction. The universe, as we know it, is getting bigger. We're getting smaller, which has been threatening, you know, forever, right? That goes back to Galileo. It goes back a lot further. So, yeah, our place in it. And yet, and this is really something interesting, and Eric and I have been trying to wrap our heads around and stuff, is to think about – so the more we know through this imaging, how do we – it's still something we can't touch. Outer space is like beyond the clouds for all of us except a few astronauts.
Charles Lindsay, a multimedia artist and artist in residence at the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Eric McDougall, founder and principal of Black Ink San Francisco. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you very much.
They're both part of Moogfest Sounds of Space panel. They're going to talk Saturday at 11:30 at Diana Wortham Theater in Asheville. And for more information, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Appalachian cuisine on the state of things coming up. Stay with us.